Hello and welcome to this episode of the Beyond podcast. I'm your host, Robert Crichton, and today we have a full cast performance of Bosworth Field by Sir John Beaumont, performed live from the stage of the Key Theatre in Sudbury. It was recorded before an audience on Thursday, the 20th of July, 2023, when the whole event was nearly derailed by a train strike, which I refer to in the live introduction. Apart from technical tweaks, this is the show as performed that summer day. The performance was followed by a discussion of the poem, which will follow on the podcast very soon. But for now, I pass you over to Past Robert to introduce the show. Enjoy.
On the 22nd of August, 1485, two armies met at Reedmore, to fight for the throne of England. The battle, once engaged, took about 2 hours, or the length of this show. If you don't want to know the result of the Battle of Bosworth, please look away now. Hello, I'm your host, Robert Crichton, and I'd like to welcome you to this corner of the Beyond podcast. And we are in this wonderful Key Theatre in Sudbury for our 2 hours of battle. We will explore the legacy of Bosworth and the literary and dramatic aftermath of the short reign of Richard III. Unfortunately, due to a train strike, we've had to slightly change the shape of our show. So we're going to start with the piece Bosworth Field itself, and then in the second half, we're going to go into the history. We were going to do it the other way around, you know, ease you into it gently, but you look like you're ready for the hard stuff. So we're going to go straight in with that. But so that you don't get lost as counties fly past you in the heat of battle, getting killed or doing the killing, I will introduce the cast and the flow of the action before we start. If you haven't switched off your mobile phones, please do so now, as they haven't been invented yet. A narrator will start the show, telling you of the civil wars that ended with Bosworth. This narrator is Pamela Flanagan. Pamela will be telling the story from King Richard's side, and the king will be played by Simon Nader. Now, he will always be referred to as the King or Richard, but there are other kings in the text. The pretender to the throne is the Earl of Richmond, played by Gillian Horgan. This is Henry Tudor, usually referred to as the Earl or Richmond, not to be confused with Richard. The telling of the story from the Earl's point of view will be via our second narrator, Kareem Cronfley. You may notice a pattern. Richard's side, Henry's side, apart from when we run out of mics. The story begins in the early hours of the day of the battle. Richard sleeps badly, threatens his followers, including Catesby, performed by Kit Maguire. Richard even kills a sleeping watchman, played by no one because they don't say anything. The Earl, however, is blessed by the ghost of King Henry VI, played by Sarah Golding, with a crown. The only person to get a crown, oddly enough. After some stirring speeches to the men on the battlefield, the battle itself begins. Now, there are lots of hand-to-hand fights in the battle, but most of the important players are these. Thomas Stanley, as played by Hayden McCabe, has his son held hostage to ensure he fights for the king. In the end, his son, though threatened with death, will survive, and his family will swap sides and turn the battle for the Earl, Henry Tudor. The main thrust of the battle is between King Richard's force, led by the Duke of Norfolk, played by Rob Myson, who will fight who will fight the forces of Oxford De Vere, played by Stephen Longstaff. In this fight, Norfolk is killed by a stray arrow, a sight seen by his son, the Earl of Surrey. Yes, Norfolk's son is Surrey. Don't think about it too much. The son, Surrey, is also played by Gillian Horgan. And he, after fighting valiantly, the son, Surrey, is captured by Talbot, played by Hayden McCabe. There are other fights, moments of bravery and nobility in the action. You will witness the touching farewell between opposing friends, Byron and Clifton, performed by McCabe and Myson. You will hear Ferrers, played by Sarah Golding, talk King Richard out of murdering his hostage. And you will experience King Richard's supporter Brackenbury, played by Stephen Longstaff, fighting to the death with Hungerford, as played by Sarah Golding. You will also hear Henry Percy, Earl of Northumberland, played by Kit Maguire, sit the battle out because his dead father told him not to fight in a dream. These moments will fly by, snatches in the wider tapestry. But finally, King Richard, seeing that the Earl is within sight, charges with his men to take the pretender. But at this point, Stanley changes sides and Richard is killed in the melee. Also look out for the author of this piece, who was writing during the reign of Charles I, and spends quite a lot of his time predicting how well that reign is going to go. History is full of ironies. However, we will discuss and dissect the history of this poem and the literary afterlife of Richard III in the second half, when we will do the first half. But till then, I have been your host, Robert Crichton, and I will leave you with Bosworth Field by Sir John Beaumont. Enjoy.
The winter storm of civil war I sing, whose end is crowned with our eternal spring, where roses joined, their colours mix in one, and armies fight no more for England's throne. Thou, gracious Lord, direct my feeble pen, who from the actions of ambitious men had by thy goodness drawn our joyful good, and made sweet flowers and olives grow from blood, while we, delighted with this fair release, may climb Parnassus in the days of peace. The king, whose eyes were never fully closed, whose mind oppressed with fearful dreams, supposed that he in blood had wallowed all the night, leaps from his restless bed before the light. Accursed Tyrrell is the first he spies, whom, threatening with his dagger, thus he cries,
"How durst thou, villain, so disturb my sleep? Were not the smothered children buried deep, and hath the ground again been ripped by thee, that I their rotten carcasses might see?"
The wretch, astonished, hastes away to slide, as damned ghosts themselves in darkness hide, and calls up three, whose counsels could assuage the sudden swellings of the prince's rage. Ambitious Lovell, who to gain his grace had stained the honour of his noble race. Perfidious Catesby, by whose curious skill the law was taught to speak his master's will. And Ratcliffe, deeply learned in courtly art, who best could search into his sovereign's heart. Affrighted Richard labours to relate his hideous dreams as signs of hapless fate.
"Alas," said they, "such fictions children fear. These are not terrors showing danger near, but motives sent by some propitious power to make you watchful in this early hour. Those prove that your victorious care prevents your slothful foes that slumber in their tents. This precious time must not in vain be spent, which God, your help, by heavenly means hath sent."
He, by these false conjectures much appeased, contemning fancies which his mind diseased, replies,
"I should have been ashamed to tell fond dreams to wise men, whether heaven or hell or troubled nature these effects hath wrought. I know this day requires another thought. If some resistless strength my cause should cross, fear will increase and not redeem the loss. All dangers clouded with the mist of fear seem great far off, but lesson coming near,
away, ye black illusions of the night. If ye, combined with fortune, have the might to hinder my designs, ye shall not bar my courage, seeking glorious death in war.
Thus being cheered, he calls aloud for arms, and bids that all should rise whom Morpheus charms.
Bring me,
saith he,
the harness that I wore at Tewkesbury, which from that day no more hath felt the batteries of a civil strife, nor stood between destruction and my life.
Upon his breastplate he beholds a dint, which in that field young Edward's sword did print. This stirs remembrance of his heinous guilt, when he that prince's blood so foully spilt. Now, fully armed, he takes his helmet bright, which like a twinkling star with trembling light sends radiant lustre through the darksome air. This mask will make his wrinkled visage fair. But when his head is covered with the steel, he tells his servants that his
temples feel deep piercing stings,
which breed unusual pains, and of the heavy burden much complains. Some mark his words as token framed to express the sharp conclusion of a sad success. Then, going forth and finding in his way a soldier of the watch who sleeping lay, enraged to see the wretch neglect his part, he strikes a sword into his trembling heart. The hand of death and iron dullness takes those leaden eyes which natural ease forsakes. The king this morning sacrifice commends, and for example thus the fact defends.
I leave him as I found him,
fit to keep the silent doors
of everlasting sleep.
Still Richmond slept, for worldly care and fear have times of pausing when the soul is clear, while heaven's director, whose revengeful brow would to the guilty head no rest allow, looks on the other part with milder eyes. And at his command an angel swiftly flies from sacred truth's perspicacious gate to bring a crystal vision on his golden wing. This lord, thus sleeping, thought he saw and knew his lamb-like uncle, whom that tiger slew, whose powerful words encourage him to fight.
Go on, scourge of murder, virtue's light. The combat which thou shalt this day endure makes England's peace for many ages sure. Thy strong invasion cannot be withstood. The earth assists thee with the cry of blood. The heaven shall bless thy hopes and crown thy joys. See how the fiends with loud and dismal noise, presaging vultures greedy of their prey, on Richard's tent their scaly wings display.
The holy king then offered to his view a lively tree on which three branches grew. But when the hope of fruit had made him glad, all fell to dust, at which the earl was sad. Yet comfort comes again, when from the root he sees a bough into the north to shoot, which, nourished there, extends itself from thence, and girds this island with a firm defence. There he beholds a high and glorious throne, where sits a king by laurel garlands known. Like bright Apollo in the Muses' choirs, his radiant eyes are watchful heavenly fires. Beneath his feet, pale envy bites her chain, and snaky discord whets her sting in vain.
Thou seest,
said Henry.
Wise and potent James, this is he whose happy union tames the savage feuds, and shall those lets deface, which keep the borders from a dear embrace both. Nations shall in Britain's royal crown their differing names, the signs of faction, drown. The silver streams which from this spring increase bedew all Christian hearts with drops of peace. Observe how hopeful Charles is born to assuage the winds that would disturb this golden age, when that great king shall, full of glory, leave the earth as base. Then may this prince receive the diadem without his father's wrong. May take it late and may possess it long. Above all Europe's princes, shine thou bright, O God's selected care and man's delight.
Here, gentle sleep forsook his clouded brows, and full of holy thoughts and pious vows, he kissed the ground as soon as he arose, when watchful Digby, who among his foes had wandered unsuspected all the night, reports that Richard is prepared to fight.
Long since, the king had thought it time to send for trusty Norfolk, his undaunted friend, who, hasting from the place of his abode, found at the door a world of papers strewed. Some would affright him from the tyrant's aid, affirming that his master was betrayed. Some laid before him all those bloody deeds, from which a line of sharp revenge proceeds, with much compassion, that so brave a knight should serve a lord against whom angels fight. And others put suspicions in his mind, that Richard most observed was most unkind. The Duke, a while these cautious words revolves with serious thoughts, and thus at last resolves.
If all the camp prove traitors to my lord, shall spotless Norfolk falsify his word? Mine oath is past. I swore to uphold his crown, and that shall swim, or I with it will drown. It is too late now to dispute the right. Dare any tongue since York spread forth his light, Northumberland or Buckingham defame? True valiant Clifford's, Roos or Beaumont's name, because they in the weaker quarrel die? They had the king with them, and so have I. But every eye the face of Richard shuns for that foul murder of his brother's sons. Yet laws of knighthood gave me not a sword to strike at him, whom all with joint accord have made my prince, to whom I tribute bring. I hate his vices, but adore the king. Victorious Edward, if thy soul can hear thy servant Howard, I devoutly swear that to have saved thy children from that day, my hopes on earth should willingly decay. Would Gloucester then my perfect faith had tried and made two graves when noble Hastings died.
This said, his troops he into order draws, then double haste redeems his former pause. So stops the sailor for a voyage bound, when on the sea he hears the tempest sound, till pressing hunger to remembrance sends that on his course his household's life depends. With this he clears the doubts that vexed his mind and puts his ship to mercy of the wind. The Duke's stout presence and courageous looks were to the king as falls of sliding brooks, which bring a gentle and delightful rest to weary eyes with grievous care oppressed. He bids that
Norfolk and his hopeful son,
whose rising fame in arms this day begun,
should lead the vanguard.
For so great command he dares not trust in any other hand. The rest he to his own advice refers, and as the spirit in that body stirs, then putting on his crown, a fatal sign, so offered beasts near death in garlands shine. He rides about the ranks and strives to inspire each breast with part of his unwearied fire. To those who had his brother's servants been and had the wonders of his valor seen, he saith,
"My fellow soldiers, though your swords are sharp and need not whetting by my words, yet call to mind those many glorious days in which we treasured up immortal praise. If, when I served, I ever fled from foe, fly ye from mine let me be punished so. But if my father, when at first he tried how all his sons could shining blades abide, found me an eagle whose undazzled eyes affront the beams which from the steel arise, and if I now in action teach the same, know then ye have but changed your general's name. Be still yourselves. Ye fight against the dross of those that oft have run from you with loss. How many Somersets, dissension's brands, have felt the force of our revengeful hands? From whom this youth, as from a princely flood, derives his best, yet not untainted blood. Have our assaults made Lancaster to droop? And shall this Welshman, with his ragged troop, subdue the Norman in the Saxon line that only Merlin may be thought divine? See, what a guide these fugitives have chose. Who, bred among the French, our ancient foes, forgets the English language and the ground, and knows not what our drums and trumpets sound.
To others' minds their willing oaths he draws. He tells his just decrees and healthful laws, and makes large proffers of his future grace. Thus, having ended, with as cheerful face as nature, which his stepdame still was thought could lend to one without proportion wrought, some with loud shouting make the valleys ring. But most with murmur sigh.
Now, careful Henry sends his servant Bray to Stanley, who accounts it safe to stay, and dares not promise lest his haste should bring his son to death, now prisoner of the king.
About the same time, Brackenbury came, and thus to Stanley saith in Richard's name,
My lord, the king salutes you and commands that to his aid you bring your ready bands, or else he swears by him that sits on high, before the armies join, your son shall die.
At this the lord stood, like a man that hears the judge's voice, which condemnation bears, till gathering up his spirits, he replies,
My fellow Hastings, death had made me wise, more than my dream could im, for I no more will trust the tushes of the angry boar. If with my George's blood he stained his throne, I thank my God I have more sons than one, yet to secure his life, I quiet stand against the king, not lifting up my hand.
The messenger departs, of hope denied.
Then noble Stanley, taking Bray aside, saith,
Let my son proceed without despair, assisted by his mother's arms and prayer. God will direct both him and me to take best courses, for that blessed woman's sake.
The Earl, by this delay, was not inclined to fear nor anger, knowing Stanley's mind. But calling all his chief commanders near, he boldly speaks whilst they attentive hear.
It is in vain, brave friends, to show the right, which we are forced to seek by civil fight. Your swords are brandished in a noble cause, to free your country from a tyrant's jaws. What angry planet, what disastrous sign directs Plantagenet's afflicted line? Ah, was it not enough that mutual rage in deadly battles should this race engage? Till by their blows themselves they fewer make, and pillars fall, which France could never shake. But must this crooked monster now be found, to lay rough hands on that unclosed wound? His secret plots have much increased the flood. He, with his brothers and his nephew's blood, hath stained the brightness of his father's flowers, and made his own white rose as red as ours. This is the day whose splendor puts to flight obscuring clouds and brings an age of light. We see no hindrance of those wished times, but this usurper, whose depressing crimes will drive him from the mountain where he stands, so that he needs must fall without our hands. In this we happy are, that by our arms both York and Lancaster revenge their harms. Here Henry's servants join with Edward's friends, and leave their private griefs for public ends.
Thus ceasing, he implores
the Almighty's grace,
and bids that
every captain take his place.
His speech was answered with a general noise.
Yay!
Of acclamations, doubtless signs of joys, which soldiers uttered as they forward went, the sure forerunners of a fair event. So when the winter to the spring bequeaths the rule of time and mild Favonius breathes, a choir of swans to that sweet music sings. The air resounds the motion of their wings. When over plains they fly in ordered ranks to sport themselves upon Caister's banks. Both Oxford leads the vanguard up amain, whose valiant offers heretofore were vain when he his love to Lancaster expressed, but now with more indulgent fortune blessed. His men he towards Norfolk's quarter drew, and straight the one the other ensigns knew. For they in several armies were displayed, this oft in Edward's that in Henry's aid. The sad remembrance of those bloody fights incensed new anger in these noble knights. A marsh lay between which Oxford leaves upon his right hand, and the sun receives behind him, with advantage of the place.
For Norfolk must endure it on his face. And yet his men advance their spears and swords against this succour which the heaven affords. His horse and foot possessed the field in length, while bowmen went before them for their strength. Thus, marching forth, they set on Oxford's band.
He fears their number, and with strict command, his soldiers closely to the standard draws.
Then Howard's troops, amazed, begin to pause. They doubt the sleights of battle, and prepare to guard their valour with a trench of care.
This sudden stop made warlike Vere more bold, to see their fury in a moment cold. His ranks he in a larger form displays, which all were archers, counted in those days the best of English soldiers, for their skill could guide their shafts according to their will. The feathered wood they from their bows let fly, no arrow fell, but caused some man to die. So painful bees with forward gladness strive to join themselves in throngs before the hive, and with obedience till that hour attend, when their commander shall his watchword send, then to the winds their tender sails they yield. Depress the flowers, depopulate the field.
Wise Norfolk, to avoid these shafts the more, contrives his battle thin and sharp before. He thus attempts to pierce into the heart and breaks the orders of the adverse part. As when the cranes direct their flight on high, to cut their way they in a trigon fly, which pointed figure may with ease divide opposing blasts through which they swiftly glide.
But now the wings make haste to Oxford's aid. The left by valiant Savage was displayed. His lusty soldiers were attired in white. They move like drifts of snow, whose sudden fright constrains the weary passenger to stay, and beating on his face confounds his way. Brave Talbot led the right, whose grandsire's name was his continual spell to purchase fame. Both these rushed in.
While Norfolk, like a wall, which oft with engines cracked, disdains to fall, maintains his station by defensive fight, till Surrey, pressing forth with youthful might, sends many shadows to the gates of death. When dying mouths had gasped forth purple breath, his father follows. Age and former pains had made him slower, yet he still retains his ancient vigour, and with much delight to see his sons do marvels in his sight, he seconds him, and from the branches cleaves those clusters which the former vintage leaves.
Now Oxford flies as lightning through his troops, and with his presence cheer the part that droops. His brave endeavours Surrey's force restrain, like banks at which the ocean storms in vain.
The swords and armours shine as sparkling coals. Their clashing drowns the groans of parting souls. The peaceful neighbors who had long desired to find the cause of their fear expired are newly grieved to see this scarlet flood and English ground bedewed with English blood.
Stout Rhys and Herbert lead the power of Wales. Their zeal to Henry moves the hills and dales. To sound their countrymen's beloved name, who shall restore the British offspring's fame. These make such slaughter with their glaives and hooks, the careful bards may fill their precious books with praises which from warlike action spring, and take new themes when to their harps they sing.
Besides these soldiers, born within this isle, we must not for their part the French beguile, whom Charles for Henry's succour did provide. A lord of Scotland, Bernard, was their guide, a blossom of the Stuarts' happy line, which is on Britain's throne ordained to shine. The sun, whose rays the heaven with beauty crown, from his ascending to his going down, saw not a braver leader in that age, and Bosworth Field must be the glorious stage in which this northern eagle learns to fly, and tries those wings which, after, raise him high when he beyond the snowy Alps renowned, shall plant French lilies in Italian ground, and cause the craggy Apennine to know what fruits on Caledonian mountains grow. Now, in this civil war, the troops of France their banners dare on English air advance, and on their lances' points destruction bring, when heretofore they had no power to stand against our armies in their native land, but melting fled as wax before the flame, dismayed with thunder of St. George's name.
Now, Henry, with his uncle Pembroke, moves the rearward on, and Stanley then approves his love to Richmond's person, and his cause. He, from his army of 3,000, draws a few choice men, and bids the rest obey his valiant brother, who shall prove this day as famous as great Warwick, in whose hand the fate of England's crown was thought to stand. With these, he closely steals to help his friend, whilst his main forces stir not, but attend the younger Stanley.
And to Richard's eye appear not parties, but as standers-by. Yet Stanley's words so much the king incense, that he exclaims,
"This is a false pretense! His doubtful answer shall not save his son. Young Strange shall die.
See, Catesby, it be done."
Now like a lamb, which taken from the folds, the slaughter man with rude embraces holds, and for his throat prepares a whetted knife. So goes this harmless lord to end his life. The axe is sharpened, and the block prepared. But worthy farers, equal portion shared of grief and terror which the prisoner felt, his tender eyes in tears of pity melt. And hasting to the king, he boldly said,
"My lord, too many bloody stains are laid by envious tongues upon your peaceful reign. Oh, may their malice ever speak in vain. Afford not this advantage to their spite. None should be killed today, but in the fight your crown is strongly fixed, your cause is good. Cast not upon it drops of harmless blood. His life is nothing, yet will dearly cost, if while you seek it, we perhaps have lost occasions of your conquest. Thither fly, where rebels armed with cursed blades shall die, and yield in death to your victorious oar. Let naked bands be censured by the law."
Such power his speech and seemly action hath, it mollifies the tyrant's bloody wrath. And he commands that
Strange's death be stayed.
The noble youth, who was before dismayed at death's approaching sight, now sweetly clears his cloudy sorrows and forgets his fears. As when a steer to burning altars led, expecting fatal blows to cleave his head, as by the priest for some religious cause, sent back to live, and now in quiet draws the open air and takes his wonted food and never thinks how near to death he stood. The king, though ready, yet his march delayed to have Northumberland's expected aid. To him, industrious Ratcliffe swiftly hies, But Percy greets him thus.
My troubled eyes this night beheld my father's angry ghost, advising not to join with Richard's host. Wilt thou, said he, so much obscure my shield to bear mine as your lion in the field with such a general? Ask him on which side his sword was drawn when I at Towton died.
When Richard knew that both his hopes were vain, he forward sets with cursing and disdain and cries,
Who would not all these lords detest? When Percy changeth like the moon his crest.
This speech the heart of noble Ferrers rent. He answers,
Sir, though many dare repent that which they cannot now without your wrong, and only grieve they have been true too long, my breast shall never bear so foul a stain. If any ancient blood in me remain, which from the Norman conquerors took descent, it shall be wholly in your service spent. I will obtain today, alive or dead, the crowns that grace a faithful soldier's head.
Blessed be thy tongue,
replies the king.
In thee, the strength of all thine ancestors I see, extending warlike arms for England's good, by thee, their heir, in valour as in blood.
But here we leave the king, and must review those sons of Mars whose cruel blades imbrue, in rivers sprung from hearts like bloodless lie, and stain their shining arms in sanguine dye. Here valiant Oxford and fierce Norfolk meet, and with their spears each other rudely greet. About the air the shivered pieces play, then on their swords their noble hands they lay. And Norfolk first a blow directly guides to Oxford's head, which from his helmet slides upon his arm, and biting through the steel, inflicts a wound, which Vere disdains to feel. He lifts his falchion with a threatening grace, and hews the bever off from Howard's face. This being done, he with compassion charmed retires, ashamed to strike a man disarmed. But straight a deadly shaft sent from a bow, whose master, though far off, the Duke could know, untimely brought this combat to an end, and pierced the brain of Richard's constant friend. When Oxford saw him sink, his noble soul was full of grief, which made him thus condole.
Farewell, true knight, to whom no costly grave can give due honour. Would my tears might save these streams of blood, deserving to be spilt in better service. Had not Richard's guilt such heavy weight upon his fortune laid, these glorious virtues had his sins outweighed.
Courageous Talbot had with Surrey met, and after many blows begins to fret that one so young in arms should thus unmoved resist his strength, so oft in war approved.
And now the Earl beholds his father fall, whose death like horrid darkness frighted all. Some give themselves as captives, others fly. But this young lion casts his generous eye on Mowbray's lion, painted in his shield, and with that king of beasts repines to yield.
The field,
saith he,
in which the lion stands is blood, and blood I offer to the hands of daring foes. But never shall my flight dye black my lion, which as yet is white.
His enemies, like cunning huntsmen, strive in binding snares to take their prey alive, while he desires to expose his naked breast and thinks the sword that deepest strikes is best. Young Howard, single with an army, fights, when moved with pity to renowned knights, strong Clarendon and valiant Conyers try to rescue him, in which attempt they die.
For savage, red with blood of slaughtered foes, doth them in midst of all his troops enclose, where, though the captain for their safety strives, yet baser hands deprive them of their lives.
Now Surrey, fainting, scarce his sword can hold, which made a common soldier grow so bold to lay rude hands upon that noble flower, which he, disdaining, anger gives him power, erects his weapon with a nimble round, and sends the peasant's arm to kiss the ground. This done, to Talbot he presents his blade, and saith,
It is not hope of life hath made this my submission, but my strength is spent. And some, perhaps, of villain blood will vent my weary soul. This favour I demand, that I may die by your victorious hand.
Nay, God forbid that any of my name,
quoth Talbot,
should put out so bright a flame as burns in thee, brave youth. Well, thou hast erred, it was thy father's fault, since he preferred a tyrant's crown before the juster side.
The Earl, still mindful of his birth, replied,
I wonder, Talbot, that thy noble heart insults on ruins of the vanquished part. We had the right, if now to you it flow, the fortune of your swords hath made it so. I never will my luckless choice repent, nor can it stain mine honour or descent. Set England's royal wreath upon a stake, there will I sight and not the place forsake. And if the will of God hath so disposed that Richmond's brow be with the crown enclosed, I shall to him or his give doubtless signs that duty in my thoughts, not faction, shines.
The earnest soldiers still the chase pursue, but their commanders grieve they should imbrue their swords in blood which springs from English veins. The peaceful sound of trumpets then restrains from further slaughter with a mild retreat to rest contented in this first defeat.
The king intended at his setting out to help his vanguard, but a nimble scout runs crying,
Sir, I saw not far from hence where Richmond hovers with a small defence, and like one guilty of some heinous ill, is covered with the shade of yonder hill.
The raven, almost famished, joys not more when restless billows tumble to the shore, a heap of bodies shipwrecked in the seas, than Richard with these news himself doth please. He now diverts his course another way, and with his army led in fair array, ascends the rising ground, and taking view of Henry's soldiers, sees they are but few. Imperial courage fires his noble breast. He sets a threatening spear within his rest, thus saying,
All true knights on me attend! I soon will bring this quarrel to an end! If none will follow, if all faith be gone, behold, I go to try my cause alone!
He strikes his spurs into his horse's side. With him, stout Lovell and bold Ferrers ride. To them, brave Ratcliffe, generous Clifton haste. Old Brackenbury scorns to be the last. As born with wings, all worthy spirits fly, resolved for safety of their prince to die. And Catesby, to this number, adds his name. Though pale with fear, yet overcome with shame.
Their boldness Richmond dreads not, but admires. He sees their motion like to rolling fires, which by the wind along the fields are borne, amidst the trees, the hedges, and the corn, where they hopes of husbandmen consume and fill the troubled air with dusky fume. Now, as a careful lord of neighbouring grounds, he keeps the flame from entering in his bounds. Each man is warned to hold his station sure, prepared with courage strong assaults to endure. But all is in vain. No force, no warlike art from sudden breaking can preserve that part.
Where Richard, like a dart from thunder, falls, his foes give way and stand as brazen walls on either side of his enforced path, while he neglects them and reserves his wrath for him whose death these threatening clouds would clear, whom now with gladness he beholdeth near, and all those faculties together brings which moves the soul to high and noble things. Even so, a tiger having followed long the hunter's steps that robbed her of her young, when first she sees him, is by rage inclined, her steps to double and her teeth to grind. Now horse to horse and man is joined to man so strictly that the soldiers hardly can their adversaries from their fellows know. Here each brave champion singles out his foe. In this confusion, Brackenbury meets with Hungerford and him thus foully greets.
Oh, traitor, false in breach of faith and love. What discontent could thee and Bushir move, who had so long my fellows been in arms to fly to rebels? What seducing charms could on your clouded mind such darkness bring, to serve an outlaw and neglect the king?
With these sharp speeches, Hungerford enraged to uphold his honour. Thus the battle waged.
Thy doting age,
saith he,
delights in words, but this aspersion must be tried by swords.
Then leaving talk, he by his weapon speaks and drives a blow,
which Brackenbury breaks by lifting up his left hand, else the steel had pierced his burgeonet and made him feel the pangs of death. But now the fury fell upon the hand that did the stroke repel, and cut so large a portion of the shield that it no more can safe protection yield.
Bold Hungerford disdains his use to make of this advantage, but doth straight forsake his massy target, rendered to his squire, and saith,
let cowards such defence desire.
This done, these valiant knights dispose their blades, and still the one the other's face invades, till Brackenbury's helmet giving way to those fierce strokes that Hungerford doth lay, is bruised and gapes with Bushier fighting near, perceives and cries,
brave Hungerford, forbear! Bring not those silver hairs to timeless end. He was, and maybe once again, our friend.
But oh, too late! The fatal blow was sent from Hungerford, which he may now repent, but not recall, and dings a mortal wound.
Yeah!
In Brackenbury's head, which should be crowned with precious metals and with bays adorned for constant truth appearing when he scorned to stain his hand in those young princes' blood, and like a rock amidst the ocean stood against the tyrant's charms and threats unmoved, though death declares how much he Richard loved. Stout Ferrers aims to fix his mighty lance in Pembroke's heart, which on the steel doth glance, and runs in vain the empty air to press. But Pembroke's spear, obtaining wished success, through Ferrers' breastplate and his body sinks, and vital blood from inward vessels drinks.
Here Stanley and brave Lovell try their strength, whose equal courage draws the strife to length. They think not how they may themselves defend. To strike is all they care, to kill their end. So meet two bulls upon adjoining hills of rocky Charnwood, while their murmur fills the hollow crags when striving for their bounds. They wash their piercing horns in mutual wounds. If in the midst of such a bloody fight the name of friendship be not thought too light, recount, my muse, how Byron's faithful love to dying Clifton did itself approve. For Clifton, fighting bravely in the troop, receives a wound, and now begins to droop. Which Byron, seeing, though in arms his foe, in heart his friend, and hoping that the blow had not been mortal, guards him with his shield from second hurts, and cries,
dear Clifton, yield. Thou hither came, sent by sinister fate, against my first advice. Yet thou, no late, take this my counsel.
Clifton thus replied,
it is too late, for I must now provide to seek another life. Live thou, sweet friend, and when thy side contains a happy end, upon the fortunes of my children look. Remember what a solemn oath we took, that he whose part should prove the best in fight would, with the conqueror, try his might to save the other's lands from ruinous paws, which seize on fragments of a luckless cause. My father's fall our house had almost drowned, but I, by chance, aboard in shipwreck found. May never more such danger threaten mine. Deal thou for them as I would do for thine.
This said, his senses fail and powers decay.
While Byron calls,
stay, worthy Clifton, stay, and hear my faithful promise once again, which if I break, may all my deeds be vain.
But now he knows the vital breath is fled, and needless words are uttered to the dead. Into the midst of Richard's strength he flies, presenting glorious acts to Henry's eyes. And for his service he expects no more than Clifton's son from forfeits to restore.
While Richard, bearing down with eager mind the steps by which his passage was confined, lays hands on Henry's standard as his prey. Strong Brandon bore it, whom this fatal day marks with a black note, as the only knight that on the conquering part forsakes the light. But time, whose wheels with various motion run, repays this service fully to his son, who marries Richmond's daughter, born between two royal parents and endowed a queen. When now the king perceives that Brandon strives to save his charge, he sends a blow that rives his skull in twain, and by a gaping hole gives ample scope to his departing soul, and thus insults.
Accursed wretch, farewell. Thine ensigns now may be displayed in hell. There thou shalt know 'tis an odious thing to let thy banner fly against thy king.
With scorn he throws the standard to the ground. When Cheney, for his height and strength renowned, steps forth to cover Richmond, now exposed to Richard's sword, the king with Cheney closed, and to the earth this mighty giant felled. Then, like a stag whom fences long withheld from meadows, where the spring in glory reigns, now having levelled those unpleasing chains and treading proudly on the vanquished flowers, he in his hopes a thousand joys devours. For now no power to cross his end remains, but only Henry, whom he never deigns to name his foe, and thinks he shall not brave a valiant champion, but a yielding slave.
Alas! How much deceived when he shall find an able body and courageous mind. For Richmond boldly doth himself oppose against the king and gives him blows for blows, who now confesseth with an angry frown his rival not unworthy of the crown. The younger Stanley then no longer stayed. The earl in danger needs his present aid, which he performs as sudden as the light. His coming turns the balance of the fight.
So threatening clouds, whose fall the ploughmen fear, which long upon the mountain's top appear, dissolve at last, and vapours then instill to watery showers that all the valley fills. The first that saw this dreadful storm arise was Catesby, who to Richard loudly cries,
"No way but swift retreat your life to save. It is no shame with wings to void the grave."
This said, he trembling turns himself to fly, and dares not stay to hear the king's reply, who, scorning his advice as foul and base, returns this answer with a wrathful face.
"Let cowards trust their horses' nimble feet, and in their course with new destruction meet. Gain thou some hours to draw thy fearful breath. To me, ignoble flight is worse than death."
But at the approach of Stanley's fresh supply, the king's side droops. So generous horses lie, unapt to stir or make their courage known, which under cruel masters sink and groan.
There, at his prince's foot, stout Ratcliffe dies. Not fearing, but despairing, Lovell flies, for he shall after end his weary life in not so fair, but yet as bold, a strife. The king maintains the fight, though left alone, for Henry's life he fain would change his own. And, as a lioness, which compassed round with troops of men, receives a smarting wound by some bold hand, though hindered and oppressed with other spears, yet slighting all the rest, will follow him alone that wronged her first. So Richard, pressing with revengeful thirst, admits no shape but Richmond's to his eye, and would in triumph on his carcass die.
But that great God, to whom all creatures yield, protects his servant with a heavenly shield. His power, in which the earl securely trusts, rebates the blows and falsifies the thrusts.
The king grows weary and begins to faint. It grieves him that his foes perceive the taint. Some strike him that till then durst not come near. With weight and number they to ground him bear, where trampled down and hewed with many swords, he softly uttered these his dying words.
Now strength no longer fortune can withstand. I perish in the center of my land.
His hand he then with wreaths of grass enfolds, and bites the earth which he so strictly holds, as if he would have borne it with him hence, so loath he was to lose his rights pretense.
Bosworth Field by Sir John Beaumont was recorded live at the Key Theatre in Sudbury with thanks to Joe Fawcett, Jack Lawson, Sharon Buckler and the theatre team, as well as everyone in the exploring sessions who contributed to our understanding of this text prior to production. Join us again for The Road to Bosworth Field, coming soon on this podcast. This episode was hosted by myself, Robert Crichton. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook or Instagram at Beyond Shakes. Visit our website at beyondshakespeare.org or support our work by becoming a patron at patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. Patrons get early access and exclusive content every week and also get to vote on the plays we work on next. Join us there and become part of the conversation.